following program was pre-recorded, and the views expressed do not necessarily represent those of this station or its management.
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control.
Welcome to Education Nation, where we tackle the biggest issues in American education. School is now in session. Here are your hosts, Headmaster Rebecca Hagstrom and co-host Mark Durkin.
Hey, teacher, leave the kids alone.
Well, good evening, and thank you for joining us here in Education Nation. I am Headmaster and host Rebecca Hagstrom, and it's a privilege to join you every Saturday evening here on AM 1280 The Patriot. And, of course, I'm joined in studio once again with our producer of Education Nation and my co-host, Mark Durkin.
Another good evening. How are we doing this week, Rebecca?
I am doing great. I'll tell you, we've kind of gotten through this cold snap, and now the weather is supposed to be very, very warm.
Yes, they're saying, I think, January was just cloudy most of the month.
I know. We talk about the weather a lot here in Minnesota, don't we?
We do. We have nothing else to do.
Right.
Right, in these months.
We're buried under the snow.
Yes.
Well, in August of 2019, the New York Times launched a series of more than 30 essays, artistic productions, live events, and a multi-episode podcast series, all with the same goal in mind. The newspaper's self-proclaimed purpose was to reframe history, convincing Americans that our nation's true founding occurred not in 1776, as all of us were taught in our schools,
but
in 1619, when 20 slaves came ashore in the Jamestown colony.
20 people.
That's quite the statement. That's quite the goal that they have there.
It is. In fact, the New York Times newspaper insists that America's founding ideals were false when written, and anything that makes America exceptional grew out of slavery. Our guest tonight tells us this reframing distorts America's progress and the exceptional ideas that drive it.
Yeah, for sure. Well, joining us by telephone tonight is Catherine Kirsten, and Catherine is a writer and an attorney, a senior policy fellow and founding director at the Center of the American Experiment, having also served as its chair from 1996 to 1998. Catherine has also served as a Metro columnist for the Star Tribune from 2005 to 2008, and before that was an opinion columnist for the paper for 17 years. Catherine, it's an honor to have you join us again tonight on Education Nation.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
Yes. Well, we always love, and we know you're one of our popular guests, too, on the show. So how did this idea first become the idea for the 1619 Project? How did it first come together?
Well, I think it is just part of the American left's larger project of reframing history generally in order to convince people that our nation is just irremediably flawed and that we're going to have to see a social and cultural transformation, political transformation, led by them, of course.
Yeah. of course.
Right wrongs that are, you know, as they say, in the DNA of our nation. I mean, there's clearly a larger agenda here.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think it's interesting that it's come from the New York Times. You know, often it comes from elite circles, but it tends to be more in the education realm. This is the first time that I can think of anyway where it's coming from a journalistic source. How unusual
is
that?
Not only that.
Yeah.
They actually had an ad on the Super Bowl.
Yes, I saw that.
Promoted this. And I think a primary fruit was intended from the beginning, and that is they wanted to influence the way that American public schools and probably private schools teach about the origin of our nation. And
yes.
I read recently that the Pulitzer Center has created a curriculum and distributed it based on what the New York Times is saying here to now more than 5,000 schools across the country. So clearly they want to reach our young people with this damning message about the evil supposedly at the core of this nation.
Yeah. Oh, it's very
disturbing. And from what I understand, too, Catherine, I mean, didn't the New York Times really pull out just all of the stops as far as the different forms of media expression, not only using print, but putting together a podcast, and they had different artistic displays?
Absolutely. And it's important to point out that this project of theirs has been very severely criticized by some very prominent American historians.
Mm.
But their response has essentially been snarky rejection.
Unbelievable.
This is a very ideologically driven. It's not about history as a search for truth.
Right. I was just going to say, don't confuse us with the facts. They just want to they want to reframe it, as you said at the very beginning.
And shout down the opposition in the process.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Well, that the phrase, we often hear it in a lot of different circles, especially during election season, but we also hear it in the study of history, the phrase American exceptionalism. It's often used in describing the founding of our country. And, you know, despite America's shortcomings, and no one denies them whatsoever.
Mm-hmm, right.
And there's no nation on the earth that's perfect. But why is America truly exceptional?
Well, for the reasons that at least those of us beyond a certain age learned in elementary school, this nation was launched by visionary founders who saw this as a great experiment in ordered liberty, in democratic self-governance. I mean, this is entirely, this notion of a nation founded on ideas of justice and equality and freedom was utterly, utterly unique in the world at that time. And although, Mark, as you point out, we've had fits and starts, this nation's history really has been one long progress toward freedom, a city on a hill, as the Puritans said so long ago, to serve as a model for all others.
Right. So then go ahead. What was that?
Millions flocking here. Millions and millions of people flocking here to take advantage over the centuries of that freedom.
Right. Which, to me, this is one of the biggest holes in the left's arguments, is that at the one hand, they want to say that we are kind of, you know, rotten at the core as far as our founding goes, and that it was racist from the beginning. On the other hand, they want to open up the borders and let anybody come in because everybody wants to come in. Why do people want to come in? Because they do know that this is an exceptional nation. So,
right. That's a big inconsistency.
Yes, it really, definitely. Well, in contrast to this idea of American exceptionalism, how does the 1619 Project aim to recast Americans' concept concerning the founding of this nation?
Well, of course, they want to say that this nation is wholly corrupted by a history of slavery and racism and inequality. And to make that case, they use distortions and half-truths and outright falsehoods about the nature of our founding ideals and what's happened since our founding. And they do what the left in a number of areas now in terms of historical revisionism. They create this kind of simplistic and false good guy, bad guy narrative. And so, of course, it's – well, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to make a comment. I was going to ask you this question because I am not a historian, so I think you probably have a much better handle on it than I do. But my recollection is that the Jamestown colony was completely – they completely died, correct? Is that correct, the Jamestown colony?
Well, I don't know, but not – I wouldn't say the Jamestown colony completely died, but it was very different in its orientation initially than what happened in Massachusetts with the Pilgrim Fathers and the National Association of Scholars, which is a wonderful group of basically college professors concerned about this kind of thing, has launched something called the 1620 Project, not the 1619, but the 1620, because that was Pilgrim, the Pilgrim's arrival and Plymouth Rock.
Right.
And these are people who brought their families who were searching for religious freedom and meant to stay here. That wasn't the case with the Jamestown.
Right. That's what I thought.
Founding.
And I think that that's an important distinction for people to understand that, yes, there was a Jamestown colony, but their values did not match what the country was eventually founded upon.
Yep.
And that was the Mayflower Compact.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that, of course, plays no role whatsoever. It's never mentioned in the 1619
Unbelievable.
Project.
See, again, there. Yeah.
Well, we are discussing the reframing of America in the New York Times controversial 1619 project that did debut last August of 2019. We're discussing this here on Education Nation, here on AM 1280 The Patriot with Catherine Kirsten, a senior policy fellow and founding director at the Center of the American Experiment. And Catherine, you had just mentioned the good guy, bad guy narrative and how misleading it is, because it does rest on several central falsehoods. We'd like you to take some time now to share with our listeners just some of the historical misconceptions that exist as it pertains to how the project portrays slavery.
Yes, exactly. Well, this project is essentially nothing about the fact that until recently in human history, slavery and human bondage were really the unquestioned norm across the world.
Right.
Ancient Egypt, Greece, Rome, all across Asia, here in the New World, the Incas and the Aztecs, and actually Native Americans even here in Minnesota. And in the early 1800s, about three-quarters of the world's population is estimated to have been either in slavery or serfdom of some kind. And that continues today. There are nations still where there are 40 million people or so across the globe are estimated to be in slavery. So this is not something for which America bears unique responsibility at all.
That's an important point.
Distinction, absolutely.
Yes, it really is. You've written that the New York Times creates the impression that most slaves in the Atlantic slave trade were brought here. So first, you're pointing out that slaves were the norm, not that we by any means think that that's a good thing. Certainly was a horrific thing, but it was the norm. So it's not just America that was participating in this. But then within the Atlantic slave trade, the New York Times creates the impression that most of the slaves were brought here to the U.S. From your research, how true is the idea that Americans bear unique responsibility and should feel overwhelming guilt today?
Right. Well, actually only between 4% and 5% of slaves in the Atlantic slave trade were brought here to what is now the United States. The other 95% went to Latin America and the Caribbean. And 40% of that of the total went to Brazil alone.
Wow.
So you know, it's by just focusing on America, you create again this sense that we are uniquely evil, but we don't have to address what about the vast majority of slaves who went to the rest of the New World, and that says nothing about that slavery's institution across the rest of the world, especially in the East.
Yeah, and not only that, but the 1619 Project also lays blame not only on Americans but white Europeans as well.
Yes.
In fact, you know, Europeans were latecomers. That's what you've written. If you'd explain for our listeners what the slave trade looked like in parts of the globe several centuries earlier.
Sure. Well, one huge omission from the 1619 Project is the role that Arabs played in the slave trade. It's been actually called an African Holocaust. What the nature of their slave involvement. Arab slave traders removed slaves from Africa for about 13 centuries. That happened only 3 centuries in the Atlantic slave trade. So Arabs were really critically important, and that's omitted in the New York Times piece.
Well, you've also pointed out that the New York Times is essentially silent about another fact that doesn't fit its narrative in the 1619 Project. Explain for our listeners how Africans themselves were central players in the slave trade.
Yes, well, the slave trade simply couldn't have happened without the intimate involvement of Africans. There was a fascinating Wall Street Journal piece on this a few months ago, and that piece said that buying and selling human beings was part of African cultures long before the first white people landed in Africa. What the Europeans couldn't go into the interior of Africa to find slaves. What they did generally was to wait on the coast, wait off the coast for African traders. And there were actually whole tribes or slave trading ethnic groups like the Afik people of Nigeria who brought the slaves to them. And there were more Africans who were kept in slavery by Africans themselves, even at the height of the Atlantic slave trade, than were sent to the Americas.
Which in some respects is not surprising when you look at the history of the tribes. There's so much tribalism and so much infighting in Africa that dates back, you know, obviously centuries and centuries. And you still see some of that even today.
Yes,
there are definitely slaves in Africa today.
Yeah, as there are also in Haiti. Haiti was a slave. It was started by, in fact, those were slaves that revolted. And yet there are still slaves in Haiti. So the very people that were slaves who revolted now turn on their own people, and there are still child slaves, especially in Haiti on a regular basis in the slums, particularly. Yeah. Back in 1998, then President Clinton issued a formal apology for slavery during a visit to Uganda. And the response from the president of Uganda was much different than what President Clinton was expecting. Can you explain that?
Well, I'll just quote from what the Uganda president said. He said, African chiefs were the ones waging war on each other and capturing their own people and selling them. If anyone should apologize, it should be the African chiefs.
Wow.
You don't hear that in the New York Times.
No. Somehow that didn't make it into the 1619 Project.
A little more complicated than
they're trying to make it seem, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. That's quite a powerful statement, though.
It is. Mm-hmm. I wonder what his reaction was.
I don't know. Did anybody get that on camera?
I've looked for it. I can't find it.
Okay.
You know, we've been mentioning just throughout this this half an hour that, again, this project is seeking to reframe American history and really distort the country's progress. And again, it is a process of progress. The project, it charges that our founding ideals were false when they were written, and the founders didn't actually believe them is what they accuse. But here are the facts. In the Declaration of Independence, the founders stated that all men were created equal and endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. And while much of American history focuses on the Civil War and the Emancipation Proclamation that freed the slaves, how did some of the prominent founders view slavery? And what events took place at the end of the American Revolutionary War that reiterated the founders' belief that all men were created equal?
Yes, a good question. Well, there was such deep ambivalence about slavery from the Virginian founders themselves. James Madison, for example, who was from Virginia, called slavery a national evil. Of course, the founders from the North, people like Ben Franklin, opposed it, and Franklin himself was a president of an abolition society.
Yes.
The Declaration, as you say, Mark, really laid the moral, political, and social foundation for the eventual extinction of slavery. And you see this right from the beginning of the fact that when we became a nation. So after the Revolutionary War, right after it, six of the former 13 colonies abolished slavery. Mm-hmm. And the Northwest Ordinance, right after that, 1787, barred it in this huge new territory that came to us from the British. Congress abolished the slave trade in 1808. That was as soon as the Constitution provided for it. That is the slave trade, you know, the Atlantic slave trade.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Civil War, as we all know, there were 360,000 Union soldiers who gave their lives to end slavery. President Lincoln talked about that, the fact that the Civil War itself might have been the price, he said, that God had exacted from our nation because it tolerated slavery. Then right after the war, we had the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And, of course, in the 20th century, Brown v. Board of Education, Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act. And interestingly, at the time this legislation was passed, all Supreme Court justices and senators who did this were white.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let me ask this real quick, too. You know, you mentioned 1808 was the first year in which some of this abolishing could take place. Why do you think it couldn't take place immediately right after the war? Was it believed that the establishment of freedom?
Oh, you mean the Revolutionary War. Right. Sorry about
that. Okay. No, that's okay. Like the establishment of freedom and the release of slaves could not happen at the same time?
Well, this was a promissory note in our declaration. And then, as you say, in the Constitution with the 1808 date, the problem, of course, was that we inherited slavery from the British. Well, we didn't choose to create it here. Okay. And it was important in the agricultural economy of the South. So it was just too difficult to fight the most powerful nation in the world, Great Britain, for our freedom without the wholehearted support of the Southern states, which were not open to abolishing slavery, at least on the scene at that point. One of the things that happened was that everybody expected slavery to die a natural death because it really wasn't very efficient economically. And then the cotton gin was invented. And all of a sudden, slavery did become very profitable for the tiny minority of Southerners who owned slaves. So that created another barrier, which eventually led to the Civil War, obviously. Mm-hmm.
You can see why historians are upset about the 1619 Project, because as you pointed out, James Madison and Benjamin Franklin, Franklin even being part of an abolitionist society, you know, it's mind-boggling to me that they are comfortable presenting this history. Well, it's not history. Presenting this this story as though it were history when it clearly isn't. There's so much clear evidence. And, you know, I hope we have more time at the end to even kind of talk about how do we counteract this. But that's one of the things that's going through my head is we got to stop this somehow and get the truth out, because they're wisely, unfortunately, going through schools to try to teach this story.
And knowledge is powerful, and that's why we have platforms like this to get the word out.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yes.
Well, Catherine, you mentioned a little while ago that following the Civil War, there was the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution, which quickly followed, and they abolished slavery, guaranteeing former slaves legal equity, or equality, and the right to vote. And then you mentioned some black civil rights heroes, former slaves, Frederick Douglass and the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr.
Yep.
How did these two men view the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution, as opposed to what we're hearing now through the 1619 Project?
Right. Well, that's such a good question. The 1619 Project claims that our founders didn't actually believe the ideals that they included in the Declaration and the Constitution. Ironically, this is just the view of a notorious supporter of slavery like John Calhoun, who said there wasn't a word of truth in the Declaration of Independence. Now, Frederick Douglass, who was the great civil rights hero, an anti-slavery hero of the Civil War era, had a very different perspective. And he called the Constitution a, quote, glorious liberty document, unlike the New York Times. And Martin Luther King called the Declaration a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. So how odd that the New York Times would take a position opposed to Douglass and King in this respect, and aligned with John C. Calhoun.
Yeah, that is just shocking.
And the 1619 Project, it doesn't stop there. It also takes aim at America's economic prosperity, which I'm thinking it was probably leaning on trying to make the argument for economic inequality, per se. You know, how does the New York Times portray our country's financial successes?
Well, unbelievably, it says everything that made us exceptional grew out of slavery, including our astonishing economic prosperity. And the idea that I touch on in my article is that this, again, is very similar to what these Southern planters who supported slavery during the Civil War said. They said cotton is king. Mm-hmm. It was the center of American prosperity. And if the times were right, the South, of course, would have won the Civil War. I mean, how false to say that slavery somehow of this defeated Southern slaveocracy it still is the basis for our economic well-being.
Right. That's a very good point. It's an important point. So we just have a little bit of time left here, Catherine, but we wanted to get your opinion here. Given that the 1619 Project views America as racist to its core, how does the project urge Americans to view one another now? And what might the future of America look like if this vision spreads its influence?
Right. Well, it is extremely dangerous because it's a very divisive racialist ideology, and it's meant to be. So unlike Martin Luther King, we are now supposed to view each other as members of racial groups first and as individual human beings, people of character, second. This is a deadly message to be giving to young black Americans, for example, this condescending victim talk. What we need to be doing is holding up inspiring examples of the kinds of beliefs and habits and behavior that enable everybody to take full advantage of the priceless benefits of living here in America.
So well said. So true.
Yes.
And I don't know if you have some ideas for how we counteract this, but you know, how do we get like the historians that are trying to speak out about this? How do we get their word promoted? Obviously, we're covering this on our show, and there's a reason for that. We want people to hear about this. Do you have other ideas in mind at all, Catherine, for how to counteract this?
Well, you know, it's pretty tough when the media and the entertainment industry and the educational establishment.
Yes, all three. The trifecta. Yes.
But clearly that's one of the benefits of shows like yours and social media. These, you know, relatively unmediated kinds of channels of communication. And I think parents need to complain to school leaders to say this is false. It's interesting that, you know, I wrote a lot about the Edina schools, and I spoke with a young black student there who said that she approached another black student who said he was not doing well because of teacher discrimination. And she told him, he mentioned slavery, she told him that Africans themselves have been involved in slavery, and he absolutely refused to believe it.
Wow. You know, unbelievable. So
I think getting the message out the way you're doing it, and by parents going to watching what their kids are learning and into teachers, maybe even bringing in some historical evidence, which is not hard to find.
It's excellent. Excellent. Well, Catherine, we are so grateful to have you on our show today discussing the 1619 Project. And thank you to Mark for putting together our wonderful topic today. And,
always informative. I learn something new every
week.
I know,
me too. This is a big one. So thank you to our listeners. And we ask that you would take the time to listen to this podcast or other podcasts. And you can go to ednationmn.org. ednationmn.org to find this one and all of our other podcasts. Visit us on Facebook at Education Nation Radio. See you next week.